Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for the Tech Guy podcast is provided by DSL Extreme. Call 866-2-GET-NET or DSL Extreme. Hi, this is Leo, and this is the Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Radio Network on Sunday, May 6th, 2007. This is show 350. You geeks, listen up. It's time to talk tech. Hi, I'm Leo Laporte. All right, you don't have to be a geek. In fact, frankly, it helps if you're not a geek. I'm geeky enough for all of us. This is the show where we explain how technology works. We talk about issues in technology. We answer your calls. And we all do it having a little fun along the way. Technology doesn't just mean computers, by the way. There are a lot of shows like this that basically it's Windows talk. I don't want to do that. No, I'll do Mac. I'll do Windows. I'll do Linux. We have an experiment going on. We started yesterday, and this will be interesting. Kathy called in a few weeks ago. Before I go on with that story, let me just also say cell phones, camcorders, digital cameras, home theater, all of that stuff. Gadgets. Our gadget guru, Ron Rosberg, is coming up in just a little bit. All of that stuff. Web 2.0. You know, all the stuff, the exciting, interesting stuff that's happening in technology today. Even we'll delve into biotech sometimes, although I'm no biotech expert by any means, but it's fascinating. And frankly, I think the most interesting thing that's about to happen is the mixture of information technology and biotechnology. You've seen it with the Genome Project. We've mapped out the human genome. We now know, you know, in detail, this map of how humans are made. And it couldn't have happened without computer informatics, without information technology. And now the applications to which they're putting this are fascinating. So we talk about that sometimes, too. Anyway, Kathy. Back to Kathy. She called a few weeks back. She said, I have a demon in my PC. And she wasn't joking. This wasn't a figurative demon. This was an actual demon figure right on her screen. A little devil with horns that would pop up from time to time and mock her. Clearly a virus, an old school virus, because you don't see that stuff very much anymore. Nowadays, virus authors want to sneak on your machine and don't let you know they're there. But she had one of them old school viruses that was mocking her. She took it into the shop. They rebuilt it. It's an old machine, Windows ME. And now it's having all sorts of other problems. And, you know, there's a security issue with using these older versions of Windows 95, 98 ME. Windows 2000, even to some extent, aren't supported by the modern Microsoft security patches. So you're kind of out of luck. Now, Kathy's a novice user, not an expert. She surfs the net. Mostly that's what she does. She shops online, that kind of thing. I think security is very important because she's shopping online, because she's giving her credit card number out and so forth. I don't want her to have, somebody sitting on her computer watching for credit card numbers. So we're doing a little experiment. I said, Kathy, and the last time I talked to her, I said, send away for Ubuntu. She had the disk right there. She stuck with Windows ME, but now she's having problems again. I said, Kathy, take that Ubuntu disk and let's see if you can install it and use it. I think normally people think of Linux, that's the Linux operating system that she's going to use, Ubuntu as a flavor of Linux, as a very advanced, geeky, specialist operating system you wouldn't want to use if you don't know what you're doing. But I think this is an interesting experiment. I think for somebody like Kathy, this is the perfect operating system, secure. It doesn't crash. It's reliable. She doesn't have any special Windows programs she uses or needs. I mean, Firefox is available on Linux. It'll be much safer for her to do her shopping and so forth. So I said, let's try this. So we're going to do this experiment. And from time to time, we'll check in on Kathy and see how she's doing. And it could be a big, flop. I could be doing a horrible thing to Kathy here. And if I am, I apologize. But I am of the opinion now that the newest versions of Ubuntu in particular, of Linux in particular. What is that sound? It sounds like my cell phone is going off, but it's nowhere near me. Go away, cell phone noises. Linux, did you hear that little buzz? Sometimes you get that from a cell phone. You hear it now all the time, don't you? If you go to presentations or lectures, that you hear that gets in the speaker system. The weird thing is, I don't have the cell phone's way like 30 feet away because I know that and I put it far away. I don't know what's going on. It'll be an interesting experiment. We'll get Kathy back and from time to time and see how she's doing. And if this works, this could be my future recommendation for people with older systems. You know, don't try to keep it alive using, you know, out-of-date, unsupported Windows. That's risky. Maybe it's time to take a second look at Linux. Interesting story in the news today. This comes from Mackenstein.
It's alive.
Another Mac rumors site. There's about 8,000 of them, which is ironic because Apple is the tightest ship in the business when it comes to keeping leaks from getting out to these sites. So the irony is these rumor sites are often wrong, not very reliable because Apple's so close-fisted. But this story I give a little credit to because it's actually quoting an EE Times report, which is a respected industry journal, electronic industry journal, that Apple has placed an order for half a billion flash chips from Samsung. Half a billion flash chips. Now, these are 4 gigabit chips. So each of these chips is 1/8 of a gigabyte. 256 megabytes, right? Is that right? No, 128 megabytes. Times 8. I have to do my math real quick. Anyway, it's these, you know, you would probably combine these. You'd put 8 of them together. Let's see, they're 4 gigabits. Oh, I'm sorry. No, that's half a gigabyte. 500 megabytes per chip. Oh, these are big chips. 500 megabytes per chip. So you'd combine, say, 8 of them to make a 4 gigabyte nano or iPhone. Okay. So let's see. If we got 8 chips and they just ordered half a billion, that's really 62.5 million iPhones or iPods, nanos. Wait a minute. Now, they said they'll sell 10 million iPhones this year. They plan to use 62.5 million 4-gigabyte memory chips in 2007. What are they up to? What are they up to? Could it be a new iPod? Gosh, I hope so. Aren't we all just kind of, I mean, there hasn't been a new iPod in over a year. Aren't we just kind of dying for, I want a new big iPod. Maybe Apple's moving away from the hard drive-based iPods and is going to use these chips, combine these chips, and make a solid-state iPod of greater than 8 gigabytes, which is the biggest they make right now. Anyway, I think that's an interesting rumor. I don't know what it means. And as you know, as I said, Apple rumors, you got to take them with a grain of salt because Apple doesn't really tell anybody anything. Although, you know, sometimes they have to place orders and these orders do leak out. So I think there's some truth to this. It's not completely out of nowhere. An interesting story in the Wall Street Journal on Friday on MySpace pages. Of course, all the political candidates want to be hip and with it, and they want to woo the young voter. So they, you know, in 2000, it was, you know, you go on Leno you want the younger voter, you go on Conan O'Brien. Well, in 2008, it's going to be, I don't know, the MySpace page. You're certainly going to have an internet presence in 2008. So all the candidates, Republican and Democrat alike, are on MySpace, but they're faced with an interesting issue. You know, on MySpace, this is the website, the social networking website where kids, you know, teenagers really love it. you have friends. People say, I want to be your friend. And you say, okay, you're my friend. You're my buddy. And you can have that. People specialize in getting lots of friends, thousands, millions in some cases of friends. And of course, the candidates want lots of friends. But there's this problem because you have on MySpace, on your MySpace page, your top 4, 8, 16 friends. You can select how many you want. Most of them, I think the default is 16, isn't it? Or is it 8? Most of these candidates seem to have 8 or 16. But here's the problem. Who do you put in as your friend if you're Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama? Who do you put in? Or Mitt Romney? Now, see, Mitt Romney's got it easy because he's got 5 kids, so his kids are up front and center. But most of these candidates are using this friend space to create this kind of, you know, the photo op, the melting pot. This, you know, young, old, black, white, Hispanic. They've got a lot of pictures of moms and babies or dads and babies. It's, of course, just another way to sell yourself, right? And so you're using your MySpace friends as a kind of way to say, oh, look, I'm with it. I'm hip. I have a support in every sector. But it could be a problem. For instance, they talk about Hillary Clinton's MySpace. It's Hillary Clinton 2008. And her friends there, and one of these guys, they've removed him since, is pretty adult. It's pretty, has some adult stuff on his site. Hillary's got 44,670 friends, and if you look at her, you know, favorites, oddly enough, she's one of her favorites. I don't really understand that. No, oh, maybe the, I see, she has her own, oh, she has her own space, and the campaign has a space. Wow, she's doubly hip. She's also got a Peanuts character and Goofy as a friend. So I don't know. I don't know what that means. Cartoon characters love Hillary Clinton. It's going to be tough. You know, they've got to be careful who they choose. They've got to vet these close friends. It's a whole new world, isn't it? And frankly, do you think young people go and say, oh, hey, you know, Obama's on MySpace. It must be. He must be hip and with it. Hey, let's talk. 888-ASK-LEO is the phone number. 888-ASK-LEO. Anything having to do with tech, I'd like to talk to you. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Tech guy, 88 88. Ask Leo's the number, 888-827-5536. 888-827-5536. So I'm looking at a article on OutsideTheBeltway.com on MySpace friend counts. And I don't, do you use MySpace friends as a measure of how successful a candidate is or how many of their voters are on MySpace? On the Republican side, John McCain, way ahead with 16,000 friends. Mitt Romney is next with half that. On the Democratic side, though, and really of all the candidates, Barack Obama, oh, big time winner. 100, of course, he's been on MySpace for 4 years now, something like that. 142,000 friends. Hillary Clinton, just 39,000 friends, and it goes down from there. Gravel's got 2 friends. And Huckabee, 968 friends. These guys have to get on the shtick, get going, get working. That's pathetic. But I don't know if that really means anything, does it? And as somebody in our chat room just said, MySpace is the trailer park of the internet. It's not the finest neighborhood, is it? And you never know what you're going to run into. I have to say, it's probably the ugliest of all the social networking sites. If you're a candidate, you go where the voters are. And that's where most of the voters are. I've been looking at one I really find interesting called Ning, NING.com. It's kind of, you do more. It's not as easy to use as MySpace, so you're not going to see the kids on there or presidential candidates. But it is very an interest, you know, really, if you wanted to create a group or a club that looked like kind of like a MySpace page, had a social network, Ning is interesting. As for the best looking social networking site, Verb, and I've mentioned this before, VIRB.com is really spectacular. Hey, let's go to the phones. 8888 Ask Leo's a number from Ontario, Canada. Craig is our first caller. Hello, Craig.
Hey, Leo. How are you today?
I'm wonderful. Welcome to the show.
I'm a big old fan of yours, bud.
Thank you very much. What can I do for you today?
I have, a fairly simple question about iPods.
Yeah.
I have a 20 gig iPod and a 4 gig iPod Nano. Mm-hmm. Actually, it's an iPod Mini, believe it or not. Still working. And what I want to do is I want to have my music on my 20 gig iPod, and I want to put podcasts on my 4 gig iPod.
Yes, I do that too.
Yeah, I know. You've talked about that before.
Yeah.
But I only have one PC. So how do I sync my 20 gig with my music and my 4 gig with my podcast without mixing them up?
Ah, Apple has thought of this. So you use iTunes to sync them up?
Yes, I do.
Okay. When you plug in, each iPod has its own kind of iTunes account, as it will. So when you plug it in, iTunes will recognize both. And you can configure each with settings. So you'll tell one, they have different settings. So what you'll do is you'll tell the Mini, in the settings, this works really well in the newest iTunes, 7.1. But you tell in the settings, I only want podcasts. I don't want your music. And you also can say, I only want unlistened to podcasts, for instance. So you'll only have the podcasts that you haven't heard, which is really nice.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would also, on the music one, have control in a number of different ways. For instance, there always has been a box that says, only copy checked songs over. So if you don't check a song, it won't get copied. But you can even be smarter with smart playlists and so forth. And if you plug in this happens a lot to me because I have a fairly large music collection. If you plug in an iPod that can't fit all your music, it'll say, hey, I can't fit it on all on here. How do you want to handle this? And one way to do it is create a special folder that's just for that iPod. So there are a lot of ways to skin this cat, but the easiest one is just use the iPod settings. And absolutely, iTunes will know the difference between the two.
Okay, so when I plug in my 4 gig, I'll know what to do. It'll be kind of obvious.
It'll be very obvious. The first time you plug an iPod into iTunes, it says, hey, welcome, here's a new iPod. Don't forget to set it up. If it's been plugged into another machine before, if you've synced onto it before, it'll say, you're already attached to another machine. Do you want me to sync with this iTunes library? Because it'll erase everything.
That's what I was just going to ask.
That's what you're seeing. So if you're seeing that, that's just because you've put something on it before. If you're seeing that, you have a choice. Now, you can say no at this point and copy everything off the iPod before you do this.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do that in iTunes, of course. You have to use standalone software. There's a lot of it that'll copy the music off the iPod.
I would do
that if you don't have a copy of it on your PC yet.
Well, I was using a different account on Windows, like a separate account.
Yeah, you don't need
Windows.
To do that. No, iTunes will do it for you.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Good. Thank you.
Thanks for listening, Craig. And it's great to hear from our Canadian friends. That's great. Listening on the internet. Maybe they're watching the video that we're streaming. I'm streaming out today via Ustream. You can see that on the web at twit.tv/live. I was putting it on the Tech Guy Labs site, but people said, wait, I don't want to, the video plays as soon as I go to the site, and I couldn't figure out how to not do that. So it's on a separate site, twit.tv/live or live, depending on how you feel about it. The main show site, though, is techguylabs.com. I'm taking the show notes, so it might be a little slow today. Apologies, but I will get everything up there as quick as I can. I'm still a little behind from yesterday. Shuby, America's favorite high school sophomore, has the weekend off because he's got AP exams this week, and I wasn't going to ruin his college chances just so he could take my show notes. So I'm doing it by hand, so it's a little slower. That's techguylabs.com. And don't forget our chat room, 170 strong right now, and I'm sure there'll be more in there. And that is irc.dslextreme.com. 8888 Ask Leo is my phone number. Love to talk to you. Coming up, Dr. Web with another great Web 2.0 site. I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. We'll be right back.
part of the world, and you may find yourself behind the wheel of a large automobile.
Leo Laporte, I am the tech guy from the beautiful Tech Guy Labs in Northern California, and let's go a little south to beautiful San Carlos, just really in the heart of Silicon Valley, where our good friend Rick Alber lives and seeks out new things on the internet. He is Dr. Web. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Leo. Hi from sunny San Carlos.
Sunny San Carlos, the land that time forgot. In between San Francisco and San Jose, there nestles the little San Carlos.
That's right. One of those cities you drive by on the way to someplace else. And we like it that way.
And we're going to keep it that way. What do you got for us today?
Oh, I've got a real nice presentation service that you can run entirely off the net and create PowerPoint-like presentations, which you can then store within the service and give people a URL so they can see it on the net, or you can save it to your local machine, run it from there as a PDF file.
Really? And so you don't need to buy PowerPoint?
No, you don't have to buy PowerPoint. It does nearly everything that PowerPoint can do, and with some exceptions. And it's much like a couple of other online presentation packages. But what I liked about this product, which is called S-Present, what I liked about it was it's got a really nice interface, and it's fun to put together great little slideshows.
Spresent.com?
That's right, spresent.com. Now, you probably heard in the last week or two, there was an announcement from our friends down in Mountain View that Google will now add a presentation component to their Google Documents, which are already a word processing service and a spreadsheet service.
Yeah, and a calendar and email. So it seems like that's the only thing missing, really, is a presentation manager.
Right, and they're saying that that's going to be coming out in the next couple of months, I think is what their head guy, Eric Schmidt, said at
I have to say,
conference.
Though, Google has never knocked me out with its slick presentation, and I can't imagine a presentation manager from Google will be anything but utilitarian. I don't expect it to be gorgeous. Let's put it that way.
I agree. I think they'll use PowerPoint as the model and not really go much beyond it, because that's kind of the way they do it. They kind of meet your expectations, and it's obviously more convenient for many people who need to collaborate online or want to store things online, and Google gives you that, and it's a great alternative in cost, obviously, from Microsoft's Office suite.
S-Present seems like it's much more than PowerPoint.
Absolutely, and again, very fun to use. What you can do when you open up an account in S-Present, you can create as many slideshow presentations as you'd like. It's free. There's no cost to it. They'll store them for you, so you can keep them up there and run them from any browser, any place.
See, I like that, because you don't even have to bring your laptop to the next speech. Just use it on S-Present.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it's all the interface is all Flash-based, so it's slick, smooth, uses vector graphics, so things scale up and down very smoothly. And it's got a drag-and-drop interface, unlike PowerPoint, which I think is sort of choose and then click. With S-Present, you've got a set of tools that you use to build your web pages, and the tools are like text. Obviously, you can create tables, charts, insert images. They've got a whole bunch of built-in clip art. Right now, because it's not a fully completed program, you can't upload your own images, unfortunately, but they do give you a whole slew of stored clip art that you can choose from. And you can create lists, naturally, of items, and it has built-in animation, so you can select different types of movement for the particular items in your list, and when you then view the slideshow, each item will, glow or move larger or whatever as you move your mouse over it, which is a nice kind of built-in feature.
It's very slick. It is kind of a drawback that I can't upload my own images. Can I create graphs and stuff? I mean,
yeah, you can do charts. And
so I could put my data in there.
That's right.
And create charts. And I guess since I can use Flickr images, I could probably find images. But if I wanted to put a picture of me or my logo, here's a good example, my logo. Could I upload my logo to Flickr and then put it in there?
Yeah, I think that's the way you do it.
Okay. Well, that's not so bad.
Similarly, you can also upload your own video to YouTube and drop the YouTube copy of your video into your slideshow.
Interesting.
So it's a little awkward, kind of a roundabout way to get your own custom graphics in there.
Yeah, and I wish they supported more than YouTube, because I don't know how professional it looks to have that YouTube logo and button in a presentation. I guess, I don't know, maybe it's not such a downside, but
I think when, if I remember right from my test presentation, I don't think you get the YouTube play button and logo on there.
So they just take it, the video from YouTube, and embed it in their own thing. Player.
Yeah, you get your own player, which you can obviously position and resize and so forth.
Cool.
Like any good presentation product, you can have an audio soundtrack behind the whole presentation or on an individual slide. You've got buttons that can be linked to other slides in your presentation or to external websites outside the presentation. And there's kind of a freeform drawing tool also that allows you to draw lines. And I didn't get this quite to work, but apparently you can create an animation that will then play back on the slide when you run the presentation, which is kind of a nifty little feature.
It's kind of neat. They as one of their demos, I see that they're using Adam Curry's Daily Source Code podcast, and he's made a presentation that goes along with the podcast. So you could say, oh, you want to listen to our show? Go to the web and watch the presentations. You could add visuals to it. That's kind of neat.
Yeah, not too hard to synchronize that.
Right. If it's built in, it says slide timers in sync with MP3 stream. Slides include web links for more information. That's pretty slick.
And you've got, you know, layers to work with. You've got transitions between slides to choose from. And a nice choice of background images, too, and gradient colors and that sort of thing. And importantly, you can create backgrounds that are moving. So you get that sort of professional sort of skies with clouds moving sort of effect behind your slides that just makes it look really nice. And to think that you can deliver all this over the net without having to go to PowerPoint, without having to save PowerPoint in some format that can be streamed over the net, it all makes a lot of sense.
And it's free.
Well, that's important too.
You can't say for PowerPoint. Spresent.com. While you were talking, I signed up for it. It was very easy. They send you a confirmation email and you're there. Oh, there's a little S-Present music going on in the background. I got a little S-Present PowerPoint going on. Well, it's not the greatest music in the world. Hey, it's free. It's free. It does. And I have to say, I mean, I'm using, if you use PowerPoint and you really know what you're doing, or if you're on a Mac and using Keynote, which looks even better, it's going to look better than this. But it does.
Right.
It's not free, and you don't have this ability to have it on the web, which I think is really, really neat.
Right. There's ways to get PowerPoint slides or presentations on the net, of course. There's workarounds and hacks that
right.
people have figured out how to do, but it takes, you know, you got to climb that learning curve to figure out how to do it.
I wonder if there's a way to collaborate. If, for instance, I want to do a sales presentation, I guess I could give somebody a link to the slideshow and say, hey, why don't you run through this while we talk?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, interesting.
And also they promise that very soon now they're going to give you the capability to create a slideshow and then save it as a Flash, standalone Flash file, an SWF file, which would be pretty nice too.
Which then after all, that's what this is, so it shouldn't be too hard for them to do that.
Right.
Yeah.
You just download or save it to your local machine yet.
Very cool. Rick Albert, as always, I don't know how you do it, but you found yet another. And I pride myself in knowing what's going on Web 2.0, and yet you come up with new stuff I've never seen before. Here's another one that I don't think anybody's probably very aware of, and it really is great. Spresent.com. Keep up the good work.
I'll try, Leo.
We want more, Dr. Web. Well, you'll get more next week. Thank you, Rick Albert.
Thank you, Leo.
Let's get back to the phones. 8888. Ask Leo is the phone number, and line two is Mike from New York. Hello, Mike. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello, Leo.
How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. I watched you when you were on the Screensavers.
Thank you.
And on Call for Help when you were on Tech TV, and yeah. I love those shows.
Well, I'm kind of still doing it on the radio, aren't I?
Yes.
Minus some of my friends, but I'm getting more and more of them back on the show, so it's working out. We'll have to get a segment from Patrick Norton at some point.
Okay.
What can I do for you today?
I have an external hard drive, and it's 250 gigabytes. And I bought it about 5 years ago, and everything's been working fine. But 3 days ago, my computer just stopped recognizing the drive.
Oh, boy.
Yes. And
USB?
I tried unplugging it, pulling it back in.
Yeah.
And it's not, like, reading it.
It's a USB drive.
Yes.
And have you tried it on any other machine?
Yes. I've tried it on a laptop.
Okay. And it doesn't work there either.
No.
Okay. So the reason I ask that is the first thing you want to do is make sure it's not the connector, the cable, or the box that it's in. And if it's not working, actually, the first thing you've done is you've eliminated the computer. There's not a USB issue. It's not a driver issue, so forth. It still could be the cable. So you want to try another USB cable just to make sure it's not just not a bad cable. It could be the external case has fried. Or it could be the hard drive inside it. Inside a external USB container, that hard drive is a standard hard drive. It's 5 years old. It's an IDE hard drive. You could take it out and put it inside a PC. In fact, that's probably the first thing to do. See if it works in the PC minus the external enclosure and the cable. It'll show up just as a regular IDE drive. Now, you'll make sure it's jumpered properly. You'll jumper it as the secondary drive, not the primary drive, because it's not a boot drive. And if you can see it, all's well, you copy the data off. If you can't see it, then the drive itself has failed. And that's where a drive recovery program is in order. There are two kinds of drive failures. There's a physical failure, and there's a soft failure, you know, formatting error, a partition error, that kind of thing. Soft error you can fix. SpinRite will fix it. SpinRite. It's from GRC.com. That's our friend Steve Gibson's program. About $80. It will fix it if it's a soft error. If it's a physical error, if the, you know, the motor's dead, or the arm is bent, or there's grooves carved into the platter, then you got a bigger problem. You said there are companies that can take these apart and try to recover them. It costs thousands of dollars. They have to have a clean room environment to do it. It's a big deal. A company like drivesavers.com will do it, but they'll charge you. And unless that data is absolutely crucial, I don't think it's worth the money. Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. More of your calls coming up. You stay right here. The Tech Guy. 8888 Ask Leo is the phone number. 8888 Ask Leo. Taking your calls and talking high tech. Computers, the internet, cell phones, camcorders, anything to do with a digital chip. Mark in Torrance, listening on the great KFI, the mothership. Hello, Mark.
Yes. Hi, Leo. I've got everybody beat. Used to listen to you on KGO down here in LA. Sit there turning the radio at Saturday night.
You'd get it late at night, bouncing off the whatever it is, troposphere, ionosphere, skimming down. Thank you. Glad you listened. Yeah. I'm back on KGO now, thanks to the syndication, so it's really great. It's really great.
I got my computer will be sitting idle, and it's maybe a new install, and there'll be internet traffic.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm looking for is maybe an app that you might know of that can monitor traffic, IPs, where it's going.
Right.
Maybe it's just an Adobe checking for an update or something.
Exactly. Remember, your computer is going online all the time. If you've got the clock set to automatically synchronize, it could be that. It could be your email checking every 10 minutes to see if there's new mail. It's not unusual at all to see those lights blink. I understand why you're concerned, because you might see those lights blink also if a hacker's using your computer to send spam and so forth. So it's reasonable to see what's going on. There's a couple of ways to do it. You're on Windows or Mac?
XP.
Windows and actually all operating systems, including Mac, have a command called netstat that will tell you what's connected to your computer. This is probably the single most useful tool. It's not the most intuitive tool.
Uh-huh.
You're going to open up a command window, you know, start, run, CMD to open up at basically what used to be a DOS window. It's not anymore. And then at the command prompt, you'll type net, NETSTAT, netstat, like net statistics.
Uh-huh.
And there are, if you do netstat slash space slash help, you'll see a number of settings for you. And there are a number of different things to look at. For instance, if you do dash B, it'll show the executable that's making the connection or listening on the port. Those are very useful because you'll tell you what program is actually connected. Netstat tells you these are the connections that are open right now. What ports are being used and so forth. You can see what IP addresses are being accessed. If you do dash P, you'll see what protocols are being used, whether it's TCP or UDP. You know, you get a lot of information out of it. Dash B is the most useful one because that's telling you what applications are using the net right now.
Okay. Anything that's a little more
user-friendly? I'm sure there's somebody. I'll have to find out. I'm sure somebody has written a graphical interface to Netstat. I'll have to check and see. In fact, I dimly remember something like that out there.
Okay.
Then there are, you know, more elaborate programs. If you do start to worry, there are much more elaborate security testing tools out there that can, for instance, look at what packets are going out. And actually, you know, if you see all of a sudden there's some program I don't know is using the internet, you can actually see what packets are going out and what they are, whether, you know, maybe it's spam that's being forwarded. You can actually take a look at that. Ethereal is, for instance, a program that'll do that. Nmap is a program that's frequently used by security experts to see what vulnerabilities there are in a system. But really, Netstat's the tool you want. It's the one that's going to tell you, you know, who's using the internet and what right now, right?
Right, just, right. Short of Zone Alarm, which is has that, you know, can tell you what ports and what's going on. But that's,
well, and yeah, firewall will do that too. It'll tell you who's accessing the internet. There is a program called Netstat Viewer.
Okay.
That I remember we actually did this, I think, as a free file of the day on a call for help at one point that will show you, basically, it's a Netstat output in a window.
Okay.
I don't know how much more useful it'll be because it's the same kind of output. But, you know, if you want to know this stuff, you're going to have to kind of understand. There's no magic program that says, warning, warning, this is a bad program. You have to know your computer and you have to know what programs should be accessing the net and which ones shouldn't be. That'll tell you. At least what the names of the programs are. Netstat Viewer.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks very much, Leo.
Hey, it's a good question. Again, don't get crazed if you see activity lights. But that is one of the ways, and we've talked about this with Steve Gibson, our security expert, that is one of the ways you can figure out if your computer has been taken over. It's very hard to figure out if your computer has been taken over. You can't just necessarily run an antivirus or an anti-spyware program. Sometimes they'll tell you, but they won't always. If you've got a rootkit, which is the most evil kind of malware on your system, you have to use an anti-rootkit program. AVG now has a free one, Grisoft, free.grisoft.com. That's a good one. Microsoft offers one, Rootkit Revealer. There's Blacklight, which comes from the folks who do Frisk software, I think it is. They do F-Protect. The antivirus, Blacklight. Those three programs will look for hidden programs, but even then you might miss it. What if a program is on your system but is named Outlook? Well, you say, oh, well, that's my email program. But what if it isn't? And hackers are pretty sharp about getting into your system when not being detected. So you look for suspicious activity, and that's those blinking lights when they shouldn't be. The problem is modern computers access the internet all the time. Denise, Boulder, Colorado, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hello, Denise.
Good morning from the People's Republic
the wrong
of Boulder.
No, I hear you. There you go. What
Good
can
morning
I do?
From the People's Republic of Boulder, Leo. I really appreciate this program. It's the one of the high points of my week.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm glad you listen.
I do digital audio editing, and I'd really like to get out of the bloatware environment.
Yeah.
And so I took my old K7 one gig machine, and I wanted to convert it to Linux. I did some upgrades.
Good for you.
But I'm having a problem because trying to find a 2496 capable sound card.
Yeah.
I don't want to be condemned to Redbook Oblivion.
Yeah, you need the drivers. And the problem with Linux is the drivers are not written usually by the manufacturers, because most manufacturers don't spend the energy to support Linux. So you have to get a user-written driver. And if there's not a high-end audio card with a user-written driver for Linux, then you're kind of out of luck. There is a project in the Linux world for open-source sound And it would be your best bet to find the drivers for the cards that you're looking for. The Linux open source sound program project. I will put the information in the show notes. TechGuyLabs.com. Thanks for listening, Denise. Thanks to all of you. We'll be back with more. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Welcome, Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. We're here to talk about technology, the stuff that's changing this world around us, high-def televisions, cell phones in every pocket, your entire music collection on something the size of a deck of cards, internet debates for the presidential candidates. I mean, it is a technology-driven world these days, and if you don't know about it, you're missing out. In fact, it could cost you. It could cost you your job. It could cost your kids their future. This is the future, technology. So this is the show to listen to if you want to learn about what's going on right now. My idea is if you listen to this show every week, you'll be up on it. You'll know. You'll kind of be hip with it, plugged in to all the stuff that's happening in the world of technology. And that makes it quite simple, doesn't it? That's all I ask. Just listen to this show every week. You can call in, too, but you don't have to, but you can. We'd love to hear from you. 888-ASK-LEO is the phone number. 888-ASK-LEO. Or if, like me, you have trouble sometimes with your alphanumerics, that's 888-827-5536. I can't answer every question. I can promise you that. But I'll do my best, and by the time the entire listening audience has heard the question, we can almost always get an answer before the show's over, either in our chat room at irc.dslextreme.com. You can email Leo at techguylabs.com, or you can also go to the website, and I'll add information as the week goes by. That's techguylabs.com. So really, this is set up to help you understand and learn and help me answer the questions with your help. Our last caller, and I kind of ran out of time, but I just want to mention, was looking for, and this is always a trouble with Linux, drivers for high-end audio cards. And the real issue is that many companies, unfortunately, don't support Linux. So the first thing to do, of course, is to go to the company, Turtle Beach or whatever, that makes the card that you want to use and see if they have Linux drivers. And if they don't, look for another one that does. And if none of the high-end audio cards that you're looking for have Linux drivers, let those companies know, you know, hey, I can't use your stuff. I want to use it with Linux. And as more people do that, it's more likely that Linux drivers will be written by these companies. NVIDIA has done a very good job of supporting Linux. They've said, well, you know, I guess enough people are using this free open source operating system, we better support it. You know, some companies don't even support Macintosh. I mean, it's Windows or nothing. And you know, to be fair, a lot of these companies aren't big companies. They don't have infinite resources. And if they write a driver for Windows, they're getting 95% of the market right out of the box. And for many of them, that's all they can afford to do. It's a, you know, it's the same amount of expense to write it for Mac as it is to write it for Windows, to write it for Linux as it is to write it for Windows. So, of course, they write it for Windows first, but you want to encourage them to write it for other operating systems, too. And then, as I mentioned, there is this OSS project. Now, this is the other way that stuff gets handled in Linux. If somebody is not going to write a driver for their hardware, then the enthusiast community will do it. Maybe not as well. They may not be able to do it at all if the company isn't forthcoming with details about how the hardware works, but very often they could do a very good job. And OSS, opensound.com, is the attempt by the open source community to create kind of a universal set of drivers for even for the high-end cards. And there are some very high-end cards supported there. So that's the first, well, the first place I'd look is the manufacturer's site. But if the manufacturers don't do it, opensound.com. And they're doing some really good work. That's true for whatever hardware. Although, you know, places like Ubuntu now are doing Linux that just works so well out of the box with almost everything. It's almost as good nowadays as Windows. You know, I mean, you run it and it comes out of the box. Windows is still the best because, of course, everybody is going to make it work for Windows. That's the big market. So we're following Joost with interest, JOOST.com, coming very close to the launch. This is going to be internet television. They've got 100 channels from National Geographic to MTV, Warner Brothers Records, IndyCar, poker. It's really quite beautiful software. It can go full screen and gets good results. It's still in private beta test. You have to get an invitation, although I'm told, I haven't logged in a while, I do have a Joost account, but I'm told that they've opened up invitations to everyone. There's a lot of invitations. So if you're on Joost, you have, I guess, an unlimited number of invitations. And I think it's very soon, in the next week or so, that you're going to see a Joost launch. Interesting model, interesting idea. We'll see if it takes over. But every day we get one step closer to the idea of all of our content coming in over the internet. Not just records, but television, movies, even live TV. I'd love to see that. JOOST.com. Some bad news for folks who wanted to protect their kids online. The state of Utah a couple of years ago enacted a child protection registry. I think this is such a great idea. The idea was allow parents to register their kids' email addresses and then say to the bad guys, the spammers, the junk mailers, you've got to file or rather filter your mailing list through this do not send list before you send it. According to the Salt Lake City Tribune, the Utah registry is a financial flop. They thought at first it'd make some money. But most of the money, they thought they'd make a few million dollars a year. They've made less than $200,000, and most of that's gone to the company that does the registry. And not only that, but they've had to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to defend the company and the registry from legal challenges by free speech advertising and porn interests. Oh, it's really kind of a shame because it's such a good idea. My wife finally has started to use email. And the other day she forwarded me something just really ghastly and awful. You know, it was spam. It was adult spam. And she said, "Why am I getting this?" And I said, "What? You mean you haven't before?" She said, "No." And well, I'm sorry, but this is what happens. This is the internet, and it's not you particularly they're aiming this at. But it is something we all get now, unfortunately. And this is the thing that scares me, even kids. I have a lot of filtering going on in my kids' email, but really the best way to handle kids' email is an opt-in system where they only can get email from people you tell. This is, I think anybody under, say, 15... this is just going to be the way it is. I tell you what addresses you can get email from. And anybody who's not on that list, you don't get it. So if you want your friend to send you email, you have to tell me and I'll add them to the list. An opt-in list is probably the best way to do that. And check with your internet service provider to see if they offer that kind of thing. Because that's the only way to protect a kid, I think. And unfortunately, things like this registry, they just don't work. Mostly because the spammers don't filter their stuff through it. They don't pay any attention to it. Barry's in Denver, Colorado, listening on XM. Hello, Barry. Welcome. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. How are you?
I'm great. How are you today?
I'm doing great. You do great radio, and I've been listening to you and your podcast, and I just want to thank you for that.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I love doing the podcasts. I do this. I do the radio because I love it, but I get paid for this, the podcast I do, just for fun.
I can tell you have fun. I love Mac Break Weekly
thank
and
you.
Love Twit.
It was a wild Mac Break Weekly this week, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
Out of control.
That's right. Sometimes it's stand-up comedy, right?
Yeah. Well, one of the reasons, and a lot of mainstream radio people are starting to do this, we do podcasts is because we can do anything, right? Anything goes. And
right.
I do stuff on the podcast that I would never dream of doing for on this show. So it kind of gives you an outlet.
Well, you guys have fun, and I
Thanks.
Enjoy it.
I'm glad you listen.
I've got a question and a comment about HD radio.
Great.
Also, I don't know if this would help, but you were talking about NetStat.
Yes.
And for the Mac, right?
Well, Mac has its own really nice NetStat interface. I was telling the Windows people don't have something quite so
oh,
nice.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah, well, it's that network info program, right? Something
right,
like that?
Right, network
yeah.
utility. Okay.
Utility, that's it. That's yeah, right. No, he was a Windows. It's always hard for me because when they're Windows users, I have to struggle sometimes.
Right.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, there's nothing for you.
HD radio, my comment about HD radio, I've heard a lot of people talk about it, but they seem to miss a major component of what HD radio brings.
We talked about it last week. I'd love to know, because I'm a little skeptical, and I know a lot of stations are doing it. What makes HD so good?
Well, it's not just sound quality. And when people talk about comparing it to AM stereo, that's like apples to oranges.
Right.
This is an entirely different thing. Specifically, for FM can multicast. And no one talks about multicasting, and it's already going on across this country, and where an FM channel can have up to 3 sub-channels that can be decoded by the HD radio.
So it gives every station 3 different channels.
Right. So you can multiply by 4. Like here in the Denver metro area, there are several FM channels, and I'm sure San Francisco is the same, that offer a HD2. So I have a station, you know, a rock station here in Denver, and when you have an HD radio, you'll see that station, but then you'll click your dial, your tuner dial, and it'll show that station and go -2.
How do the other stations sound? Are they lower quality?
No, they are CD quality.
All 3 CD quality.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, that's the move towards digital. That's what it's all about. In fact, from the point of view of the FCC, that's why they want these technologies to come in. I'll talk a little bit about that in just a second.
Right. Yeah. And I'm not affiliated with anyone. So before I say this, I can give you the website if
okay,
you would like.
Hold on, and we will, but we've got to take a break. Leo Laporte here. I am the Tech Guy. Pressure to perform. I am the Tech Guy. 88 Ask Leo is the number. 88 Ask Leo. We're talking with Barry from Denver about high def. Actually, it's called it's HD radio, and they kind of want you to think it's high def. It doesn't stand for high def. Unfortunately, it stands for something digital, right?
Right.
Can't remember.
I forgot what it was,
yeah.
too.
Everybody thinks it's high def. Anyway, HD radio is kind of the coming thing, and you made a good point that the advantages of HD radio aren't merely that it sounds better, but that there are more stations on the same channel, which is kind of cool.
Right, and this is the case the satellite people are making, that this is going to be a competitor to them.
So because we should be able to merge, blah, blah, blah.
Right, right. Yeah. So anyway, the webpage that people can go check if they want to learn about it and also find HD stations in their area, this is the company that created the technology, and I am not affiliated.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the page is Ibiquity, Ibiquity.com.
Right.
And if you go to that page, you can read about the basic technology, but then you can click on broadcasters and click on find a station, and it'll show the United States, and you can click on your state, and it will tell you everything that is HD. And, you know, there's tons of clear channel stations that are HD.
I know, yeah.
Right. So anyway, that's all I wanted to
Thank
say.
Thank you, Barry. I appreciate it.
Okay. And my question is, I have a massive amount of music that I am encoding right now, and I'm running an iMac, 24-inch iMac, and I'm going to run out of space on this 500-gig hard drive. And I need
Who would ever thought that half a terabyte just isn't enough?
That's right. So I want a terabyte external drive where I think I ultimately want to move the library to it, but I then want redundancy to it so right. it backs up. And I just wanted your recommendation on what I should look at.
Well, given what you just told me, I mean, there are terabyte drives out now, by the way. I don't recommend them. In fact, Steve Gibson, who I talk to all the time and is, of course, probably knows more about hard drives than anybody who doesn't work for a hard drive manufacturer, mostly because he writes SpinRite, which it has to know intimately the details of hard drives. He and I both agree, don't buy too big a hard drive because we're nervous about the amount of data they're storing on these small platters. It's called areal density, the amount of data on a square inch or square centimeter. And it's so high now on these big drives that they can't be reliable. They actually have huge amounts of error correction, and there are errors happening all the time. So I think for reliability, and because you said you want kind of redundancy, what to look at is a RAID 5 external enclosure.
Okay.
What RAID 5 does is it combines multiple smaller drives, typically three drives. You don't get three times the size. You get three or four drives. You get kind of usually two-thirds the space because one-third of the space is used for redundancy. The advantage of RAID 5 is that you can pop it. If one drive fails, you pop it out and replace it, and it rebuilds itself automatically. So you have this kind of really great situation where even if a drive fails on you, and of course there's more likelihood of a failure when you have four drives, you know, you're going to have four times the likelihood one of them is going to go. Right. So you can swap a drive out. You get big sizes. You get a terabyte easily because you've got three, four, five, six drives in there. I think it's actually, it's usually four, six, or eight, as I remember. But they're expensive. The enclosures themselves usually run about $500 or $600. Then you could put cheap drives in there. And you could put larger drives if you wanted more space.
Okay.
But I think that's the best way to go. That's what I use for my network-attached storage, my big backup drive. I use an Infront NAS connection. And Infront, I-N-F-R-A-N-T. And they just make really excellent ones. And they, you know,
Infront?
That's like infant with a R in there. I-N-F-R-A-N-T. Oh, Infront.
Okay. Connection.
Yeah. And Infront, I think it's Infront.com. But you can get them at Newegg. That's where I got mine. And a lot of places sell them online. And there are other companies that make these. There's, you know, Buffalo makes a terabyte system. I wouldn't get a terabyte single drive. I would get a RAID 5 array. That's what you're going to look for.
Okay.
All right.
Great. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Barry. More expensive, but, you know, you're getting a lot of storage, and it's more reliable. And I think that's the key. You're going to put your entire music collection on there. You really want something that's not going to lose that data. iTunes is fine with it. Your iMac will be fine with it. You can just say, hey, this is where the data is. It's not in the internal drive. It's in an external drive. It's fine. They can show up as external drives or as network-attached storages either way. If you use network-attached storage, one of the advantages is you put it on the network so every computer on your network can see it. It's not an external drive just attached to one machine. A lot of companies make these. Just if you look for RAID 5 arrays, Apple makes one. Apple's is probably the priciest one out there. But I think it's a great way to go. And you get speed, you get reliability, you get performance, and you can make these even bigger. I mean, you're not stuck with a terabyte by any means. Just real quickly on the high def radio and the move towards making all broadcasting digital. That's the advantage of high def TV as well. It's why the FCC mandated that analog television stations give up their very valuable frequencies, very valuable because they're low frequency, they go through walls and so forth, and they're really of value, and move to digital frequencies because you can get more bandwidth. You can get more stations on the same amount of spectrum. Same thing with digital radio. That's the advantage of digital. Everything's packetized. You can get much more on the same spectrum. That's an advantage to broadcasters. Of course, they have to spend money to do it. They have to get new equipment, new hardware. Can be an advantage to consumers, but really the big advantage is to the FCC, which gets to resell these very valuable frequencies to others. Taking a break, coming up back, the Gadget Guru, Ron Rosberg. I'm Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy.
Tech Guy from the Tech Guy Labs in beautiful Silicon Valley. It really is beautiful today. Like 83 degrees. It's almost too hot with all this equipment here in the labs. I'm going to have to turn down the rheostats and some of the electronics in here. On the line with us right now, Mr. Gadget Guru himself, Ron Rusberg. Hello, Ron.
Hello, everybody. Beautiful Sunday. Yes, even down here in the Bay Area, it's nice.
Yeah, yeah, where it's normally very foggy. You're going to go to the Giants game and watch
Yeah, I'm going to watch the new kid pitch. He pitches over 100 miles an hour.
And, wow. Yep. Talk about heat.
Yep, absolutely. And talk about a great product today. Leo, I got to tell you about an item that I've been playing with for about a year and a half, and it's something I use almost on a daily basis. I'll be taking it actually to the game tonight. It's made by M-Fuel, initial M, F-U-E-L, and it's called their M-Fuel Power Bank. They actually
One of these. Do I have this one?
I don't know if you have this one, but you have. They also make a device for the universal notebooks. And,
that's what I have.
You can use it for the Mac. You could power. If you go to M-Fuel Direct, you'll see their website.
It's a big battery, basically.
But this one here, Leo, is their small one. This is a size, basically, of a king-size package of cigarettes, Leo.
I don't know what those are.
Right. Either do I. But I had a junior high school teacher once say, if I ever catch any of you kids smoking, I will kick your butt. He scared the heck out of me. I never had
good
a cigarette.
For okay, him. Yeah. That's a good teacher.
I'm still looking for him.
He's ready to kick your butt.
I think he's someplace around. You know,
Big deck of cards, let's say that.
Yeah, that basically is what it is. And Leo, it has an LCD on it. It comes a little puck, a little like a hockey puck thing, and it has retractable cord on it. And you just plug this in, and what I'm using to charge, listen to this, it comes with a bunch of power tips, what they call, and you can charge your iPod, you could charge your cell. I charge, for example, I have a Motorola Crazer. And actually, by the way, Motorola makes an adapter, and almost any Motorola has to have that adapter. This power pack is so smart. It will actually charge any of your Motorola devices and on the go or whatever. The LCD display will tell you how much power is in there, how long it will run that device. It has five or six displays that constantly give you the voltage. It tells you what percent. For example, the one I have here says I have 81% left in this pack. And, for example, when I'm low on my – I use my cell phone almost all day long, right?
Yeah.
And I don't have an extra battery for it. So what I do when I see it's getting low, I just plug it into this thing. It will charge it for me. And it is amazing. It is absolutely probably one of the best pieces of electronics I have. I actually have a couple of them because I think it's that great. I keep one in my computer bag at all times. It will, over a period of time, if you don't use it for like 30 days, it will discharge like almost all devices will. But if you want to run your iPod for like a 4 or 5 days or whatever you can on this thing, it has tremendous...
So it doesn't charge it up, you just would... Or does it charge it and run?
No, Leo, it will charge it up. It will actually charge it up for you. In other words,
So you plug this thing into the wall... You fill it up.
No. You don't even have to plug this in the wall. As long as it's got a full charge. Let's say I take it out and it's 100% on it, okay? And I can now, for example, when I was up at Clear Lake, I flew up to Clear Lake for a day, and I didn't have any of my adapters with me. So I had two devices I had to charge. My 8700 BlackBerry, which uses a mini USB plug, and then my Motorola uses the same plug. So I just took the puck
with that adapter on it.
But it's the same thing. A lot of them are going to that mini USB. So
I wish they all would, yeah.
Yeah, I know. I agree with you.
My Nokia still has that stupid little tiny 2 millimeter plug that nobody in the world uses.
Exactly. But this thing comes with, let me tell you here, it has, here's what it comes with. An AD05 wall charger, a DC car charger adapter. Listen to this. If you have, like, for example, I have an S50 Sirius radio. It's a portable radio. But it wasn't intended to really use portable because it had to be plugged into your car.
Right.
This thing, in the little zipper package that you get with this, it has a device, a 6-inch cord, and has a DC cigarette lighter receptacle.
Wow.
So you could plug anything, even if you had your car charger, that's all you had.
Oh, I get it. So the car charger plugs into the M-Fuel power bank.
Exactly.
As if it's in the car. Wow.
For example, GPS devices I get to play with and to evaluate, Leo, a lot of them just come with a car charger, and I need to stay inside and not run to my car to set them up. I use this device. It has 7 cell phone hot tips, 2 Ethernet hot tips, 6 USB hot tips, and a travel bag. So Yeah, it's fantastic. This normally sells for $199, and on M-Fuel Direct, they have a sale right now, $149.
I see it's $149,
so if you're looking, yeah, and if you're looking for a Father's Day gift, this is a terrific item. It's,
and then do you
I can't recommend enough.
Do you? I see it comes with a lot of tips, but you can buy, if you have something that doesn't work with, you can buy additional tips.
Let me tell you something. This, now remember, you're not going to run your portable computer. This one's not designed
for
anybody.
This is for portable,
this
for little devices, yeah.
Yes, your MP3 devices and your GPS device, stuff like that. I haven't found, it even has the Trio tip in it, okay, the palm tip.
Wow.
And stuff. So it's fantastic. I can't say enough nice words about it, but it's a device that's really saved my butt a few times because I either forgot to take the charger. This, so I could take this thing and not have to take a lot of chargers with me.
Ron Rosberg, you're the gadget guru. You have to have power everywhere you go.
This gives me power,
this
Leo.
Isn't the power up? It's the power bank from M-Fuel. And I have a couple of the M-Fuel devices intended for laptops. And it's a cool idea. It's a really cool idea. I'm glad to see they're still around.
Yes, no, they're around, and I'll probably talk about their other ones later on. Take a look at this thing. It's on sale.
MFuelDirect.com.
You got it.
Hey, and thank you, Ron. Enjoy the game tonight.
I will.
Don't sit behind home plate. I don't want you getting beaned or anything.
No, you know where I sit, Leo.
I know exactly where you sit. Yeah, those are nice seats. On a night like tonight, it's going to be warm. You're going to have a great time.
Well, I wish you were going to be there.
I'll look for you on ESPN.
Oh, hey, by the way, Leo, before I get off, I've got a service here for that I've got to tell our listeners about. I found out on what HD stands for. Okay.
It's not high def radio. It's HD radio. Something digital, I think.
No, I will tell you, this is a service to the Leo Laporte Technology Program. I will provide the definition for the letters HD in front of HD radio. Originally, the initial stood for hybrid digital, because the digital signals were carried with analog wave.
Right.
According to Ubiquiti Digital Corporation, that's been changed, and the letters HD now don't stand for anything.
I love it when they say that.
Some articles and news stories have erroneously assumed that HD stands for high definition, which has contributed to the confusion between HD radio technology and high definition HD.
Hey, we're losing our Skype connection, so I'm going to let you go. But, hey, thank you for clearing that up.
You're welcome.
Ron Rosberg, the gadget guru. And you can catch him every week on this show talking about the latest gadgets. Ron's great because he's just got such enthusiasm. And I think sometimes, now I want to be very clear about this. Sometimes people listen to him and say, he must work for this company. He loves this stuff so much. He doesn't. He's absolutely independent. He's not working for any of these companies. He's a natural born salesman, I think. And he just loves his stuff. He just loves it. Thank you, Ron. Have a good time at the Giants game tonight. Let's go to Birmingham, Alabama. Our next caller, Chris, on the line. Hello, Chris. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. Big listener and love Twit.
Thank you, sir. I'm going to come up with something question. Like Rush Limbaugh does. I have people say mega Twittos or something like that.
Right.
I don't think so. That's not going to work. What can I do for you, Chris?
I recently bought a new gateway computer with Vista on it.
Okay.
And I have an older XP computer that I moved into my den and hooked it up to my big screen TV, trying to use it kind of like a media computer. And I was trying to network them together, you know, where I could see and pull files off each other's computers, or each of the computers.
Right.
And now I cannot see either computer, but I can see the router that they're both hooked up to.
Huh. Okay, and this is because you upgraded to Vista that it all went south?
Well, no. I mean, I bought a new Vista computer, and the other one has XP on it.
But does it work? Oh, so you never tried to network it before then?
No,
because you didn't have two computers.
I mean, no.
Yeah,
right.
So there'd be no reason to. Yeah, this is very commonly a problem, and it's a particularly problem on Vista because of Vista's security. The Vista firewall is turned on, and it's just blocking access. So the fact that you can see the router doesn't really mean anything. What you want to do is see the other computer. So the way you kind of have to go through this, I'll put a link to a network troubleshooting article because there's about 20 steps to this. You got to figure out where it's getting blocked. Almost always, and the first thing to check is your security software. So I just try turning off. Do you have on XP? Do you have a firewall of any kind running? Norton Internet Security, Norton 360, anything like that?
I think I have a Avast.
Avast. Okay. You might want to check and see if it's doing that. Turn off security software just temporarily. Obviously, you don't want to keep it off forever. But very frequently, it blocks. And what happens is you can make an outbound connection, but you won't. The inbound connection won't be able to be made. And that's what firewalls and routers and security software do. They block incoming traffic. Some firewalls like Zone Alarm and Norton Security actually block outbound as well. They're using different ports. They're using port 139 and 135 and others for this connection. And those ports are usually blocked by security software. They turn off file sharing. So did you? Vista has a pretty good file sharing how-to in the help. Have you gone through that?
Yeah, I tried it, and I renamed the
did all those steps.
The work groups have to be the same name.
Have to be the same work group. They have to be on the same subnet. So both of them have to have a local IP address that begins with the same first couple of digits, either 10.0.0 or 192.168. I presume that's the case, unless you have a switch in there.
No.
Yeah,
that's right.
There's a lot of different things to try. First thing to try is to ping the other computer, see if you can actually send a ping and get a ping back. If you can, that's usually a good sign. It means just that you've got a connection, that the hardware is all working fine, and it's just the particular protocols that are used by file sharing that are being blocked. And that's just then going in and turning off that security software and knocking on it. I get this question a lot, particularly with Vista, because Vista is more secure. But anytime somebody's got security software running on their system, they're going to have problems like this. It's, I've said it before, networking was never designed for mere mortals. It's always been the province of system administrators. It's very high-end stuff, and all of a sudden here we are at home trying to do networking. The good news is you're going to bang your head against the wall. You're going to tear your hair out. I'll give you this troubleshooting, step-by-step thing. Put it on the techguylabs.com. Go through it. When you finally fix it, it'll stay fixed. That's the good news. You don't have to do this over and over again. You just have to figure out whatever it is, that one little thing that's blocking network access. Fix that, and you'll be golden. More of your calls coming up. 8888 Ask Leo. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Watching the show as well as listening. You're watching the Ustream video, huh?
Yes, I am.
Wow, that's wild.
It's really cool. I'm thinking, wow, live stuff over the internet? That's amazing.
Yeah, I don't know how they do it. The site is Ustream, Ustream.tv, and they apparently have enough bandwidth to supply.
They say amount of bandwidth,
yeah,
though.
They must, because it's streaming live video. Now, why anybody would want to watch me sit here and talk, I don't know. It's a pretty static shot. But I'm glad you're watching, Chris.
Well, for the obligatory, I've seen you forever. It's really cool to see you moving again instead of disappearing.
Do I look the same? It's been a few years since I've been on TV. I'm a little grayer, I think.
Before the whole G4 debacle happened, I used to watch you on screensavers and call for help, and then I just purchased a Zen Vision 30-gigabyte MP3 player, and I'm thinking, oh, I ought to see what there is for podcasts out there. And I'm like, oh, cool, Leo Laporte's on the podcast.
Yeah, well, and the Patrick has DL.TV and Cranky Geeks with John C. Dvorak, and I think many of the people who I used to work with at Tech TV are online.
Oh, yeah, that's pretty much all I listen to his work, is I'll download all the podcasts and listen to him while I'm doing data entry.
You must be a big old geek, Chris.
comment and a question for you.
Yes.
The comment is, I always hear you say that when you're choosing computers, that for office work, you should use a PC in general, and for home, you should use a Mac.
Yeah, it's a rule of thumb. It's a pretty good rule of thumb, but it's not perfect.
True, because you forget that a lot of the games that come out are PC-based games.
Yes, and I agree. And if you're a gamer, that is probably the single biggest exception. If you want to play PC games, obviously you need a PC. You know what I've told people in the past is buy an Xbox 360 and a Mac.
I wouldn't go that far. I'm not that the big best of a console fan.
Yeah.
But for the most part, I mean, you won't be able to play games like Half-Life 2 or Fear
or Call
of Duty. Well, Call of Duty has made that jump.
Call of Duty has, obviously, World of Warcraft's on both platforms. But you're absolutely right. For PC gaming is PC. Although I have to say, with Vista, I'm hearing so many people having problems with Vista.
That's why I'm sticking with XP.
Yeah, yeah. But I agree with you, and that's it. That's why it is a rule of thumb. That's the one home application where Windows absolutely excels. There's no real reason for that. That's just because people develop for Windows because that's where all the users are. It actually would be easier to write games for the Mac because it's a much more heterogeneous platform. You don't have to worry about 80 different video cards and sound cards. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But companies don't want to do it, and I don't blame them. I understand they've got a limited budget.
Yep.
So you're right. Absolutely correct.
Now, my question is, I purchased a Sony Vaio desktop computer a couple years ago, and I've been having some DVD burner issues. When I first got it, I was able to pop a blank DVD in, and I've been backing up WAV files and movie files and pictures and stuff that I've collected over the years. I'm like, finally I'll be able to get them on DVD. Used to burn at 16x, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
Lately, it won't burn at 16x. It'll basically give me a coaster.
Interesting.
But if I go into the program that I actually used to burn with, and I lower the maximum speed that
it
can actually burn at,
yeah,
it'll burn at like 8x.
Yeah.
And then I've had to turn it down to 6x. And I'm wondering if it's a power supply issue or if it's the DVD drive just starting to quit.
It could be the media.
Really?
Yeah. So I would absolutely try some other media to make sure that that's not the problem.
Okay, because it's the media I'm using.
The media says 16X, but I would, big deal. Try other brands, even some cheap brands. I use Ritech because it's the cheapest brand that works. Yeah, but there's a lot of different brands. That's the first thing I'd try is the media. Does your program have a test procedure? Most burning programs do.
I believe so, but for the most part, every time I've used it, I've never had a problem.
Oh, interesting. So it works in the test at 16x. It's only when you're burning real data that it doesn't work.
Well, no. What I'm saying is I've never used the test.
Well, I would use the test and see what it says.
Okay.
And that will give you some information that you don't have currently about what its capabilities are. There are a lot of reasons. I don't think it's a power supply issue. It's probably not a hardware issue, but remember, burning reliably, especially at 16x, which is for a DVD, that's super high speed. That's 8 times the CD rate. So we're talking, 128K. It's actually rotation that they're talking about. That's very high speed rotation. So I'm not surprised it's having trouble at 16x. That's really on the edge of what it can do anyway. Trying different media sometimes helps. Making sure the computer's not busy doing other things should help. It's no longer the issue, the case that if you interrupt burning in the middle of it, that it'll fail. But it's, at the same time, you want to make sure that the computer is not going to have any competition for that burn. I'm not sure what other factors might be involved. You might want to look at drivers as well. And maybe try another software package. But one thing that does happen for sure is that your computer gets older, it gets slower, and it could be that. So there are a lot of different possible causes, but the first one I always look at is the media. You've got to make sure you have media that can handle it, and even if it's labeled 16X, it may not be. And I would absolutely run that test. That test will tell you that's the burning software doing its best to figure out, based on all those factors, what it can do, the highest rate it can do. And if it can't do any faster, then you may be stuck at 8X. 8X is still very, very fast. Remember, it's 8 times faster than the comparable CD rotation rate. This is all based on how fast a CD rotated. So 1X, a 1X CD burner was rotating at 1X speed. They got up to 40X on the CD burners. And the initial DVD burners were 2X, but that's the rotational speed of a DVD, which, is, as I understand, is faster. I believe it's 8X times. So 8 times 16, was that 128? That's a lot faster. That's an awful lot faster. We're going to take a break. I want to remind you my podcasts are online at twit.tv. So if you need more Leo all week long, that's where you go, twit.tv. Our show notes are at techguylabs.com. And they're a little behind right now. Mike B's helping me out. Shuby, America's favorite sophomore, is on vacation this weekend. We'll get some more information in there, so links and so forth. And I'll be back here same time, same bat channel next week. I hope you'll join me. For those of you staying here, we've got more calls to come. I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Have a great tech week. Good day to you, Leo Laporte here,
the tech guy,
talking high tech, as I do every single week right here. And high tech is the whole spectrum, everything with a chip in it, gadgets, MP3 players, camcorders, cell phones, of course computers, the internet. Right now, I mean, the internet and gadgets are where everything's happening, you know, smartphones, internet, web 2.0 sites, where you just, I mean, everything in the world. I mean, this is a very exciting time. Rebecca Baker, my producer, is coming up. She's got a fun little website she's found. It's not, I don't know if it's useful in any way, but it's kind of cool. And it is very web 2.0. Well, we'll tell you about that a little bit later on in the show. But mostly it's your calls. And that's really what makes this show so much fun for me, is hearing what you have to say. Not just your questions, but your comments, your suggestions, your predictions. 8888-ASK-LEO is my phone number. 8888-ASK-LEO. Jot it down so you can call in. 888-827-5536. And I'll talk about anything. I'll do my best to answer your questions. Can't answer them all, but I'll do my best. At least can point you in the right direction. And certainly our vast listening audience has the answer to almost anything you can come up with. 8888-ASK-LEO is the number. Howard's on the line from Vista, California, aptly named. Does everybody in Vista have to use Vista, Howard?
No, I don't have to use Vista.
I think Microsoft should have paid you some money to use your name.
Well, that's okay. I use 2000 on my home computer.
There you go. I still think Windows 2000 was the best Windows ever made.
Well, it seems to work well on a little bit older machine.
Yeah, and, unfortunately, they're not keeping it up to date anymore, and that's kind of a problem.
Yeah, yes, it is.
Yeah. So what can I do for you?
Well, I'll be moving to actually hit the road, do some little bit of traveling, and I'm looking at getting rid of my desktop and going to a laptop.
Right.
And I want something small.
Okay.
You know, for battery power, too. And I was looking... kind of looking at two machines. One just at the end of my budget or outside is the Sony 43NB. It's
I love these. Those little Sonys are so gorgeous. Ugh,
they
just,
are.
I just adore them.
They are. And it looks like it has just about everything in the world in it. Very fast processor, lots of memory. It does have Windows Vista. But I was looking at Lenovo, and it comes with XP, and it has a lot of similar specs. It's got the same processor and stuff like that.
The Lenovos are basically the old ThinkPads. As you know, IBM sold the company and the name and the brand to the Chinese company, Lenovo. Initially, I thought Lenovo was doing a very, very good job with these ThinkPads, not only keeping the quality up, but innovating in new ways, like these ultralights that they're starting to do. They have a great tablet. And I was frankly very impressed, but I am hearing, starting to hear from people that the quality has started to go down on these. Now, this is, you know, all anecdotal. I don't know if there's of any research that says this or anything, but I am starting to hear from a number of people who are fans that the Lenovo ThinkPad quality is starting to go down a little bit. Now, Sony, the negative on Sony is their support is awful.
That's what I heard.
Yeah, they act like the United States doesn't, frankly, exist. And so, you know, if you buy a... So that's the negative on Sony. But I do think the Sonys are prettier Which one? You're looking at the X series in Lenovo?
Well, it says Lenovo 3000 N100.
Oh, the 3000. Okay. Yeah, the lightest Lenovos are the X series.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. But I think they're, I frankly think they're good-looking computers. The 3000s are a little more price better. But that's because they're slightly lower end in some respects. I'm surprised Lenovo is still selling XP. That's a little odd.
Well, that was a little bit of an advantage. It was actually at one of the retailers.
That's what you want.
Retailers. And I saw that they had the XP. A lot of programs I have currently have XP.
Right. Unless if you're happy with XP, it probably isn't a good idea to rush into a Vista, no matter where you live.
Right.
These are Core 2s. I would suggest if you think you're going to upgrade to Vista at some point, make sure you get that Vista upgrade certificate. Usually those are fairly inexpensive, kind of almost free upgrades to Vista. So at least you'll have the option.
Okay.
And which you're looking at the lightest one? Which one are you looking at?
Well, I don't think this is the lightest one, but it seems a very powerful.
Oh, you said the N series you're looking at. Is that right?
Right. Yeah. And it had the T72 processor.
Yeah.
And it was for $1,200.
It's a Core 2. Yeah. How much RAM you get for that 512?
One.
Good. Good. One's good. You'd like two with Vista, but it'll run fine in one. It just depends on how heavy duty the programs are that you're running. I hate to say don't buy a Lenovo based on these kind of, it's not rumors. I mean, I'm talking to people who use them, but it's hard to say whether that's really widespread or just a few people have had problems with it.
Yeah. Well, is there anything that you particularly like for just a general all-around machine? I watch videos and I scan just personal pictures on it.
I think either one of those is going to be fine. I've mentioned before that I like the Fujitsus, particularly because of the screen. They have an ultra-portable that's also nice, but they are pricier. They're more in the Sony price range. And if support is an issue for you, I think Dell is probably a better choice. If you think you need support, you sound like a pretty sophisticated user.
Well, I'm not a computer guy. I used to be electronics repair and had
You know what you're doing.
Exactly.
So support is a secondary issue for you.
That's correct.
As it is for me. I mean, and that's one of the things you have to consider. Am I going to be calling for support? If not, then you don't really care if it's a Sony. I love the Sonys. I think that they make the most beautiful and have consistently ultralight portables. They're very, very good for the light ones. Dell has a pretty good lightweight. I use an XPS 1200. It's a 12-inch, and it's very light. It's a nice computer. It doesn't have the same fit and finish as the Sony. It feels a little more utilitarian. A few more bumps and, it looks more industrial, whereas the Sony just looks slick as heck.
It sure does.
Yeah. And frankly, Lenovo is kind of more on the industrial side. It's a business. They're really a business computer. And that's what all the business guys use is ThinkPads. I would also take a look at the keyboards because they are different on all three. But I don't think you'd go wrong with Dell, Lenovo, or Sony. If money were no object, I'd probably go with the Sony, since you don't need tech support.
Yeah. Well, I can squeeze that out, but I was looking at it and I said, I don't want sleekness to be my...
Right, and that's what you pay for. That's why it's a premium, frankly.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's exactly what that premium is for, because as you point out, it's the same hardware inside.
Right.
I don't think I've really helped you much, but there's some talking points anyway.
Well, I appreciate your insight.
Thanks for the call, Howard. I really appreciate it. One of the things that I like doing the show, because I do get feedback from people all the time, and I kind of watch the tenor of it, and I am starting to see more problems with these Lenovos, which is a shame, because I really think that ThinkPad brand was a great brand, and it would be nice. It is nice when I can say, clearly, unequivocally, oh yeah, no problem. The best is a Lenovo, or the best is a Sony, but it's not like that anymore, unfortunately. Each has its own advantages. Dell is the best for support still, although it's gone downhill from the heyday of Dell, when it really had, amazing support. But it's still, a lot better than a lot of these other companies. And second best, support-wise, Gateway's not too bad. It's starting to fall off across the board, though, isn't it? Gateway makes some nice lightweights too, but I think if I were going to pick one, I'd go for pretty. I'm all about looks. I would go for the Sony, to be honest with you. Wendy, Los Angeles, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hello, Wendy.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm very frustrated. I'm a songwriter, and I have limited abilities, but not as limited as my computer knowledge. I'm almost illiterate except for emailing and Googling. So, but I'm having, like, for my own stuff, it's fine, but I'm writing for somebody else, and he needs me to do styles that I'm not good at. So I got something called an Ambox, an interface, and it's kind of like an engineering soundboard, and I just don't understand it at all. I don't know the first thing that they're talking about.
Did you get Pro Tools?
And I have 30 days in which I can return it.
Yeah.
I was wondering, do you know anything that could do, you know, music enhancing for dummies?
Yeah, I think Ambox is for professionals. Really hardcore professionals. It's from the guys who do Pro Tools. It's from DigiDesign, and it comes with the Pro Tools software.
Exactly.
Yeah, and frankly, it's too much for me, and I do a lot of audio editing and computer stuff, obviously. So Pro Tools, while it is what every record studio uses, I'm not surprised you're saying it's way too much for me.
Oh,
yeah,
it's like a foreign language.
Are you on a Mac or a PC?
I especially switched to a Mac from a PC for this,
How's GarageBand working? Try GarageBand. Have you tried it?
Oh, is that the name of
that's the music program that came with your Mac.
Oh, for goodness sakes.
And you know what? You're going to love it.
Now, will that allow me to plug my keyboard into it and record and make CDs and stuff?
Yep.
Oh, you're kidding me.
Nope. And it came with your Mac. You already have it. Before you return the M-Box, although I think you're probably going to want to return the M-Box because it's overkill, play with GarageBand a little bit. If you get more advanced, there are Ableton Live, for instance, is a great program, L-I-V-E from Ableton. There are Reason. There's so many great programs that I think are easier to use than Pro Tools. But start with GarageBand because you've got it. It's free. And frankly, I know a lot of songwriters that use it and love it. Leo Laporte here. I am the Tech Guy. Leo Laporte, I am the Tech Guy. Good to see you here. 8888 Ask Leo is the number. 8888 Ask Leo. Of course, now singers, songwriters, musicians of all stripes use computers to make their music. It's a revolution. And I think that people who are musicians, who are talented musicians, don't necessarily know or understand the computer stuff. But it's worth learning because it's such a great tool. And I think GarageBand's a good place to start. Let me talk, though, a little bit about the different kinds of programs, because there are different kinds of programs out there. Really three big categories. And you may get a program in the wrong category for what you want to do. Best way to find out about this stuff, by the way, is in many communities have stores that are kind of computers and music. In fact, there's one in San Francisco called Computers and Music that's the greatest place in the world. You want to find a store that is kind of designed for musicians to use computers, and they know about this software, and they can advise you, they can walk you through it. They're online, computersandmusic.com. I didn't notice that. But you really want to talk to somebody, and you want to talk to them about what your needs are. Now, I didn't have enough time to really get into it with our last caller, but let me talk a little bit about the different kinds of programs. There are recording programs, programs designed to just digitally take the audio that you're recording, and you probably have a mixer or an interface of some kind. I use a mixer with a FireWire output, or you might get something from, say, Motu or Presonus that takes microphone in and instrument jacks, plug them in, and then gets them into the computer. And there are programs that will record, multi-track record that audio. On Windows, for instance, I use Audition to do that. Apple has a program, Soundtrack Pro 2, that just came out now that it does multi-track recording. There are a lot of free programs that do this. Audacity from SourceForge. Another great inexpensive program on the Mac for that is Amadeus Pro. That's about $40. But these all are just purely for recording and editing. So they'll record the music. Cubase is a good one. They'll record the music. You have a way as a wave file. You can edit the music. You can remix it. Of course, you can record multiple channels, then mix them down. You know, record your drum line and then your bass line and mix them down. But that is not what most people use. Pro Tools has it's primarily that. It's primarily a recording program. Many of these programs then have effects you can add, you know, reverb and so forth. But they focus on recording and editing. The second category, and I think that this is the category really that our caller wanted, is focused on MIDI. And that's what GarageBand is. It's a MIDI interface program. You take a digital keyboard, a MIDI keyboard, you plug it in via the USB port, or in the old days you'd use a MIDI connector, into the computer. And the keyboard itself doesn't really make any sound. It's a controller for the software. And then you assign a sound to the keyboard. So you might use it as a drum machine and lay down a rhythm track. You might use it as a strings and lay down a strings track. It will record, but it records not the analog sound coming out of your keyboard, but it actually is recording the instructions, the keystrokes, and then assigning a sound to those keystrokes. And I suspect that's what our caller wanted, and that's certainly what GarageBand will do. GarageBand is also a looping program, and that most MIDI programs are. And looping programs take existing sounds and allow you to paint with those sounds, to paint a song. And they're great, especially for songwriters, because, you know, in the case of most songwriters, they're not necessarily instrumentalists. They don't want to, you know, play the drums, the keyboards, and the banjo. They want to write a song. So that's why GarageBand is so great. GarageBand, you'll use pre-existing drum kits, pre-existing rhythm. You'll lay it down, maybe put a bass line in there, and then you can play the melody on your keyboard on top of it. So you've got basically a band behind you, a backing band with pre-recorded sound that you paint with, and then you can play your keyboard. You can even record your voice, by the way, because there is analog recording capability in GarageBand. Suzanne Vega is a very good example of a singer-songwriter who uses GarageBand to sketch out songs. And I know a lot of artists do that. They will sketch out their songs. So I think for a singer-songwriter, if you've got a Mac, you've already got the free program that'll do it. It's GarageBand. If you want to get a little more fancy, Ableton Live is a similar kind of program. It focuses on loops. It allows you to do recording and even performance. A lot of people, and that's why it's called Live, a lot of people use Live to do live performances because it can control all this music and play it back. It's a lot more sophisticated and a lot harder to understand, but and it's a lot more expensive. It's about $500. So if you get more sophisticated, Ableton Live is another good choice. There are lots of programs, especially on the Mac, for doing this. But Pro Tools is really probably overkill for most people. And especially if what you really want to do is sketch out song ideas, because you'd have to record every line. You want a MIDI program that has the loops, lets you lay out the basics using existing recordings, and then play your melody on top of it. And that way you can sketch out song ideas. And I think GarageBand is a great choice. I think it's for most people, it's all you need. And it's certainly a good starting point that's easy to understand. It's really what Apple has done is remarkable. The third category of programs, by the way, is the synthesizer programs like Reason, which emulate a variety of different kinds of synthesizers and amplifiers, and they allow you to create sophisticated sounds. And most musicians will use a combination of these tools. No, there's no one program they'll use. But again, I think GarageBand is the right answer. All right, we're going to take a break. Come back in just a little bit with Rebecca Baker, my producer, who has a great website, a fun website for you to play with. And more of your calls, too. 8888-ASK-LEO is the number. Chat room is hot and heavy. 234 people in there at irc.dslextreme.com. And don't forget our website, techguylabs.com. I am Leo Laporte. We're talking tech. I'm the Tech Guy.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy, and I'm here in the Tech Guy Labs. There's a beautiful, warm, actually hot days in the 80s today. Rebecca Baker is in our studios in Sherman Oaks, where I think it's also a pretty hot day. She is our esteemed show producer. But in her job during the week, she goes out and surfs the net quite a bit, trying to find good stuff for the show. And every once in a while, she comes back with a pick for us. Hi, Rebecca. How are you today?
Good. How are you, Leo?
Is it hot? Is it warm?
It's so hot. But that's just because I'm a hot producer, right?
It's so hot, baby. You are a hot producer. What did you now? You send me, and I should say, one of the things that really makes this show fun to do is Rebecca sends me links every week of interesting stuff. And you have kind of a... shall I say a quirky eye for stories, some interesting stories you've sent me.
I do. I love the quirk. You know, give me the unusual stuff. I read all that mainstream stuff every day. I want the unusual aspects.
That's why the net is great, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Millions and millions of web pages at your fingertips. I mean, it's amazing what we've got now.
Well, tell us something fun and new and different.
This is something fun, and this is something totally mindless. So you're not going to learn anything. You're not going to... become a better individual, probably. This website's called Sketch Swap. And what you do when you go to the site, it gives you a blank palette and a pencil tool. You don't get the fancy paint stuff or the, you know, spray paint cans or things like that. It's just a pencil tool, and you basically doodle.
I'm doing it right now. I'm drawing a teddy bear.
Oh, that's adorable.
Okay.
And then when you're done, hit Submit Drawing.
Uh-oh.
It takes your picture away, and then what comes back to you is somebody else's drawing.
I hope it's better than my drawing.
Well, normally that's the case for me, is I send a really awful doodle, and I get back a masterpiece.
Oh, somebody sent me a cube. This is so funny. So this is somebody else on the site who's doing their own drawing.
Mm-hmm. And the neat thing is that it comes back to you in real time, so you see the actual thought process of the artist.
Isn't this hysterical?
And like I said, it's totally mindless. It's just a time waster. But I love it. I think it's fantastic.
Well, you know what? It's what it is it's very much kind of the new web, where it's instead of you just being by yourself, it's you. It's a social thing. And I think that's kind of funny. Okay, I'm going to draw another one. I'm going to draw a little millipede. And it's got two tiny legs. I'm such a bad artist. But it doesn't help that I'm using my mouse. Submit drawing. You tend to get kind of simple drawings, right? Or do you get more elaborate ones sometimes?
You know, it's kind of a mix. I get a lot of anime sometimes.
Wow, really?
Yeah, yeah. So you never know where this person is, you know, what country
they're
in.
No, they don't tell you anything, do they?
Not at all. So it's just kind of a mix as far as what you're going to get.
Oh, you know, I'm not going to get anything done now for the rest of this show.
This
is good.
Oh,
somebody's doing an anime drawing. So there must be a lot of Japanese people using this, maybe. Because it's got big eyes and everything.
I checked out their About section, and it looks like the site was formed in Germany.
Oh, interesting. Well, maybe there's a lot of... Look, this is elaborate. Holy cow. Wow, Rebecca, what a fun site. Sketchswap.com. I'll put a link in the show notes.
And if you have a concern as far as inappropriate drawings, they said in their About section that they approve of every single sketch before it gets submitted.
You're kidding.
I know. That's a lot of sketches to go through.
There's somebody sitting there going, okay, that one's all right. Okay.
Right.
That's interesting. Oh, look, this is becoming much more elaborate. But yeah, you would expect to get kind of kids drawing nasty things. So you don't get
Or, you know, bad words and stuff, but they really look out for that.
Oh, this person signed it. Oh, that's interesting. So I could sign them, huh?
It'd become a collector's item.
Rebecca, I'm not going to get anything done. This whole show is going to go down the tubes. If you're calling in and I'm not paying any attention to you, it's because I'm swapping sketches. I'm drawing a big comfy chair right now. Oh, how funny. I think if a real artist got a hold of this, it would really be kind of cool. Rebecca Baker, our esteemed producer, get back to work. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
I can't stop sketching. It's so fun. So we were talking about music programs, and I really, you know, I am such a tyro. I'm no musician, and I certainly, you know, I use some software to edit and record my podcasts, but Ashley Witt is in our chat room, and he is one of the great composers out there and uses computers and music all the time. So if you have questions, go into the chat room, irc.dslextreme.com, and ask Ash. He says in the chat room, he mentioned that the MBOX program our caller was using is
not considered pro because it's limited to the number of tracks it can record. Wendy was just writing songs, so I think it's certainly adequate for her. But I do think Pro Tools is probably overkill. He mentioned he uses FL Studio. I forgot to mention that. That's a very affordable program. Probably the next step up past GarageBand. And you can get it Windows or Mac. And there's a very, I think there's an under $100 version of it. FLstudio.com. It used to be called Fruity Loops. And it's loop focused. It's very similar to GarageBand. They call it digital audio workstation software for Windows PCs. Oh, it's not for Mac. It's Windows only. So that's a Windows program, or you could run it in Mac and Boot Camp, I guess. Back to the calls we go. Line 5, Sydney's on the line from Temecula. Hello, Sydney. Welcome. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. Thank you very much. I was curious on your opinion. I'm looking into buying a new HP desktop.
Okay.
Comes with a AMD Athlon 4400, I believe.
Yeah.
The guy at the store, when I asked him, I said, am I losing anything by going with Athlon? AMD instead of Intel, and he said no, it's actually better and runs cooler. Is that true?
No, it's not. It used to be true. The guy hasn't kept up with the latest greatest, but that's all right. AMD, okay. You know, I thank God for AMD because they kept Intel honest. They kept the pressure on Intel to keep prices low and innovation up, but something happened about a year ago. AMD was absolutely the price performance leader, no question about it. Intel made a huge breakthrough, and these new Intel Core Duo processors are faster, lower power, and, ironically, less expensive than the AMD processors. You still see AMD processors in low-end computers, but they are not comparable.
Okay, so if
not that that's going to make any difference to you. I mean, not necessarily. I mean, remember, processors today are, in most cases, much faster than users need.
Yeah, my only concern was, you know, in terms of quality, I guess.
I think the quality is the same. Certainly the compatibility is identical.
Okay.
But what's happened is just that Intel kind of leapfrogged AMD, and it's going to take AMD at least till 2008 to catch up. So it's a seesaw battle. Right now, Intel has the top.
Right. Yeah, okay. So this computer I'm looking into, it's Windows Vista Premium.
Yeah.
Comes with 2 gig of memory, and this AMD processor. Does that sound like it'll all work fine?
That sounds like a good combination. HP makes pretty good desktops, I have to say. That's a good dual.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's a good dual core processor from AMD. Again, not quite the Core 2, but pretty darn good, and certainly fast. You know, unless you're doing. Are you launching rocket ships or anything? I mean, if you're not calculating, you know, trajectories to the moon.
Actually, you know what? My needs are so simple. I spend time on the internet and mostly do word processing.
It's plenty for you. Absolutely.
Yeah, and your screener agreed with you. She said HP has made tremendous leaps in the last few years.
They have.
Because I had an HP some years ago, and it just, like, blew up on me one day, and that was my other concern.
They're currently the number two PC brand, and seesaw number one brand with Dell, and I think they make very, very good computers. I don't think there's anything wrong with them.
Okay, great. So it all sounds good.
Yeah, I'd say go ahead. The only thing I don't like about HP, and it's not just HP. Most of the guys do this. They load it up with the trialware, you know, crapola that you don't really want, you know.
There's a program,
and I mentioned this yesterday, called PC Decrapifier that, pardon my French,
serious?
I'm not kidding. That's the website, PCDecrapifier.com, and you run it, and it has checkboxes for all the junk they put on those things, like, you know, AOL.
Okay,
and
so speaking of crap, I know AOL, I wish they would just go away already.
Well, if you don't use AOL, it's wasting space on your drive, right? And they put
exactly
Earthlink, and they put Net Zero.
And so much of it.
Yeah.
So much of it.
So this program's great. You just go through it, and it just eliminates all this.
Okay, but if you don't mind, what I wanted to ask you is, this premium edition, does it have built-in virus protection, or do I still need to go out and buy a virus program?
You still need to buy an antivirus. It has built-in anti-spyware and has much improved security, but it is not an antivirus.
And which do you recommend then on the antivirus?
Our sponsor, and I have to say this as a disclaimer, they are an advertiser on the show, but one of the reasons they're an advertiser is because I've supported them long before they were an advertiser, is NOD32.
Okay.
NOD32 from www.eset.com is very good. Nod 32. And it's ESET.com. The reason I like it is because it doesn't at all bog your computer down, and that's a real problem with a lot of these big packages like Norton and McAfee. They have so much.
Yes, I tried the McAfee, and it kept freezing my computer.
Who wants that? I don't want that. So that's one of the reasons I like it.
Yeah. All right, Leo, since you're so nice, one more question, please.
Sure, Sydney.
Do I buy one of these transfer cables to send all my stuff from my XP edition computer to my new Vista computer, or
you can that works fine. There's one called the Tornado that's kind of neat. It's a USB cable, has the software in it.
Okay,
you just plug it in and it does the job. But you could buy a transfer program. The truth is, this in my opinion, this is an opportunity for you to back up your data on a CD anyway. So I would just do it. I would just
so
back
I can
it
just
up.
Do it the old-fashioned way.
That's what I would do because you want to back it up. And here's any excuse to back up.
I'm sorry?
Any excuse to back up, and this is a good time to do it. You're moving to a new computer. Take this stuff on your old computer. You know, a great idea, spend an extra $100 and get an external USB hard drive. Back everything up on the external drive. Then you could put it on the new computer, but you've got that external drive as a backup device. And as we all know, if backup's not easy, readily available, you're not going to do it. And while CDs are a great way to back up, and I actually encourage you to do it because you can make multiple copies, sometimes an external hard drive is the fastest and easiest way to do it. Yeah, you can get one of these external cables, you know, the transfer cables. That's fine. But, hey, backup. Use this as an opportunity to backup. And incidentally, I'm going to make this a habit every week. This is your reminder. Backup today. Let's all back up. While you're listening to the show, let's all back up your data. And that's my new plan. While you're listening to the show, just, you know, make this a weekly habit. Oh, yeah, unless you're in the car, of course. But if you're at home, or just remember when you get home, today's the day. Let's back up our data. Put it on a CD. Put it aside. Bring it to the office so you have a copy of it. Leo Laporte, I got a break. I am the Tech Guy. The Tech Guy, the waning moments of this show. Time enough to get a couple more callers in. 8888-ASK-LEO is the number for future reference. Gary, Boulder, Colorado. Welcome, Leo Laporte. This has been Colorado today. I love that. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Hello, Gary.
Hi, Leo, my favorite teacher.
Oh, thank you. That's high praise.
Ever since Screensavers and Call for Help.
Cool.
In fact, you're the reason all my friends call me when they're having a problem.
I turned you into a geek, huh?
Oh, yeah. I was a musician before that, and now I'm a musical geek.
Oh, well, hey, you can help us with our caller earlier this hour. Do you use a computer to do your music?
Yes, I do.
And what do you use?
I have XP.
Okay.
I use the old Cool Edit Pro, which I guess now is Audition.
Yeah, that's what I use. That's a pure recording and editing program.
A nice program to try out, though, for Windows is Wavelab.
Wavelab, okay. And come to think of it, I forgot, but Audition also has loops in it. It does have looping. So yes. You probably could do a lot of those things. And then Wavelab, huh? I don't know Wavelab. What? Tell me a little bit about that. That's from Steinberg? Those are the people who do Cubase. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they have a demo that you can use and try out.
Couple of good Windows programs, and I wish I'd mentioned FL Studio. That's a great program. Of course, she's on a Mac, so this is for the Windows folks. So, Windows, what can I do for you today, Gary?
Well, I got one. Finally, I got one that I can't fix. Friend of mine, the motherboard. We've got 768 megabytes, a half a gig, and a 256.
Okay.
And the motherboard sees that, but the operating system only sees 248.
Hmm.
And I imagine part of that is for the video memory in the motherboard.
Right, that's where that extra 11K or
but it doesn't matter what slot I put a 250 or a half gig in, it still only reads that.
Yeah, generally on motherboards, you want to add memory in not all motherboards, but most motherboards, you want to add memory in pairs and matched pairs at that. I'm wondering if, because these are unmatched, that's part of the problem. But tell me about the motherboard. What kind of motherboard is it?
It's a Dell.
Oh, okay.
Dell computer.
Okay.
And so, it came with half a gig.
Right. And so what I would suggest doing is matching that half gig instead of putting a 256 in.
Well, what happened was a friend of hers swapped memory out with her.
Yeah.
He had 228 and took her 256. And eventually he replaced her both her 256s, but it still only read the 248.
If
you could put a 512 in, which they've been on sale lately.
Oh, I see. She had a pair of 256s.
Right.
Yeah, which would indicate to me that this motherboard does want paired memory. It's also possible. That's interesting. So it had two 256s, and it doesn't see the 512 you put in, basically.
Right.
Make sure that 512 is a match for the...
They're all PC 3200.
Okay, good. All right.
And the BootIny file does not have a maximum entry in it, and the little tab on msconfig.
My best guess, and I'm pretty sure this is the case, is that you need to add it in pairs. And it's seeing the first one, but it doesn't see the second one. What I would do is see if you can borrow a 512 meg PC 3200 stick somewhere and put it in. And I bet you what you'll find is that it sees a gig now. The fact, you know, you say the motherboard sees it, that doesn't necessarily mean it delivers it. It sees it, but it doesn't necessarily make it available. And I think that that's probably the problem. It's not that Windows is having trouble with it. It's really that the motherboard isn't, in fact, giving you all the memory. Good luck. It's nice of you to be the tech support guy for your friend. Rick, Parker, Colorado. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hello, Rick.
Hey, Leo. How's it going?
It's going great. How are you?
I'm doing well. Leo, I'm thinking of purchasing a Mac Pro. And
okay.
I have a lot of Windows data from a Windows computer. And
okay.
I'm listening to you talk about Parallels quite a bit. And what I was wondering was, if I get a Mac Pro, I install Parallels, I put XP or Vista on it, is there a way where I can transfer all my data?
Sure.
All my pictures, all my audio files,
sure,
et cetera, into the Mac Pro so that they can be seen by both the Windows operating system inside of, say, a Parallels file,
yep,
or a partition.
You bet.
And the OS X, yep, operating system.
Parallels has a ability, and almost all virtualization programs have something like this, to share part of the hard drive. So in Parallels, there's something called the shared Parallels drive. And it can, in fact, be your whole, you tell it what it's looking at. It can, in fact, be your whole Mac disk. Or it could be the Mac document folder. And it just shows up as if it's a drive in Windows. So you would copy it to the Mac. You'd put it in your documents folder, wherever you felt like it. And you just make sure that that folder is part of your Parallels shared folder. And that's done in Parallels. The nice thing about Parallels, you can try it free for 30 days. So you can, before you buy it, I would suggest you set it up and see if it'll do exactly what you want. But in general, I haven't had any trouble sharing data back and forth like that. In fact, Parallels has a nice feature that if you copy it to the PC, or rather copy it to the Mac from the PC, you can then drag it. Let's say you've got a Word document and you want to have it available in Windows. You'll drag it from the Mac Finder into the Windows window. And at that point, Parallels will say, okay, you have two ways to do this. If you want to have your Windows have access to the Mac drive and have a single copy that both Windows and Mac shares, we can do it that way, or you can say no, and we'll just copy the file over to Windows, and you'll have two copies, one in Windows, one in the Mac.
Excellent.
So you really, and sometimes you'd prefer that, you want it to be in Windows for whatever reason. You don't want it to be this Windows and Mac sharing the same file, but you have the choice.
Okay, well, that definitely sounds like
great way to go. If you get a fast enough a computer, and a Mac Pro is very fast, Windows runs at a very good speed. The only thing you really can't do is gaming. And of course you don't get the arrow interface if you're using Vista, but who cares? That's cosmetics.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, thanks, Rick. I'm glad you called. I'm glad you all listened today. Well, can we get back together again next week, please? I'd love to do this again with you. During the week, you want to hear more of me, you go to twit.tv. That's the podcast network. And we've got something like a dozen shows every week on security, Windows, Mac, the internet, everything you'd want to know about computers. It gets a little geeky in there, so it's for the more hardcore listener. Twit.tv. And the show notes are at Tech Guy Labs, and I'll get those updated at techguylabs.com. Have a great geeky week. I'm Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I'll see you next time. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy. Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you'd like to hear the show live, check your local listings or visit our website, leo.am, for a list of stations where you can hear the Tech Guy radio show live on the air. You can also hear archived shows at leo.am and subscribe to our podcast there, or open your podcasting client and subscribe to the feed at leo.am/podcasts/KFI. Thanks to Howard Bailey for the music for this podcast. You can find more of Howard's work at soundclick.com. Thanks to Premier Radio Networks for syndicating the show. Most of all, thanks to you for listening. This is Leo Laporte. I'll see you next time on The Tech Guy.